In today's podcast episode, I talk with Renee Wegerson, who was appointed by President Biden as the first director of a new agency the president created last year, called the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Health, or ARPA-H. If the name rings a bell, it's because it's inspired by DARPA, the agency that develops innovations for the Defense Department and has been credited with hatching world-changing technologies such as drones, GPS, and ARPANET, which became the internet. Time will tell if ARPA-H can generate achievements of that caliber for health. That's what President Biden and Congress are expecting, as ARPA-H has been funded at $2.5 billion over 3 years. But how will the agency figure out which projects to take on, especially with so many patient advocates clamoring for their particular disease to be the recipient of moonshot funding for rapid progress? I talked with Dr. Wegerson about the opportunities and challenges, what lessons ARPA-H is borrowing from Operation Warp Speed, how she decided on the first ARPA-H project, which was just announced recently, why a separate agency was needed instead of just reforming existing ones like HHS and the National Institutes of Health to be better at innovation, and how ARPA-H will make progress on disease prevention in addition to treatments for cancer, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, among many other health priorities. Looking at Dr. Wegerson's resume, it seems as if maybe a couple decades ago, she took a time machine into the future, saw that this agency and position would be created, and has spent her career up to this point building credentials specifically for it. She was a program manager at DARPA, where she focused on applying gene editing and synthetic biology to the goal of improving biosecurity. For her work there, she was given the Superior Public Service Medal. And because that wasn't enough ARPA experience, she also worked at another ARPA in the federal government that leads advanced projects in intelligence, called IARPA. Before that, she was in charge of technical teams in the private sector, working on gene therapies and disease diagnostics, among other areas. She's also been a vice president of business development at Ginkgo Bioworks and headed innovation at Concentric by Ginkgo. Her training and education includes a PhD and undergraduate degree in applied biology from the Georgia Institute of Technology, and she did her postdoc as an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow in Heidelberg, Germany. As Dr. Wegerson told me, she's in the hot seat. The pressure is on for ARPA-H, especially after the need and potential for health innovation was spotlit by the pandemic and the unprecedented speed of vaccine development. Soon we may get to see if ARPA-H can produce something in health that's equivalent to DARPA's creation of the internet. I'm Matt Fuchs, and this is Making Sense of Science. Hi, Dr. Wegerson. It's exciting to be talking with you and to have you as a guest on Making Sense of Science. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much, Matt, for having me and excited to talk a little bit about ARPA-H.
Great. Well, I find ARPA-H and your work really fascinating. It's such important work, and I've enjoyed following and writing about all of the discussion leading up to when ARPA-H was born last year, and it's amazing to see it alive and kicking and up and running now. So it's really a pleasure to connect with you.
Great. Thank you.
So let's jump into the questions. You were chosen to be the first director of ARPA-H, a brand new agency, and that happened last October. So you're over 7 months into the job. Congratulations, by the way. And it seems like a role your resume was built for. But are there any ways in which your experience working in labs, the private sector, DARPA, IARPA, has not prepared you for what you've encountered thus far at ARPA-H?
That's a great question. I haven't gotten that one before. So
that would be an interesting little wrinkle. Yeah.
So, you know, what's so interesting about this job is I've worked in government before. So I have those experiences. I've worked in the private sector before in a couple of startups. So I thought going to this job, wow, my government experience is going to help me be prepared. My startup experience will help me be prepared. But is this intersection that, like, it doesn't happen very often where you're trying to start up a new agency inside the federal government where a lot of the day-to-day feels a lot like a startup, but yet you're building things inside of one of the biggest bureaucracies in the United States. And so it's this really interesting collision of those two worlds that I hadn't maybe fully been prepared for until I was actually in the hot seat.
I do want to ask a little bit about the really interesting relationship between ARPA-H and NIH and HHS. There was a lot of discussion about where
Our base should be located geographically. I know that that conversation continues. So I think I have a couple of my questions later on, get into some of those questions. I did want to talk about the mission areas of ARPA-H. And it's great to see that crafting preventative health programs is one of the four mission focus areas of ARPA-H. I'm curious what that actually means in practice. Do you expect that about one-fourth of ARPA-H programs will be in line with this preventive, proactive focus area?
Yeah, so as you noted, we've actually launched four focus areas for the agency. We felt that these were important to highlight as the areas in health that we think at ARPA-H, these are ripe for further investment, that ARPA-type investment can really advance the state of the art. And one of the ones that you've just flagged is an office called Proactive Health. And this is really making sure people don't become patients in the first place, making prevention that best cure, whether it is diagnostic or detection capabilities, all the way to behavioral and social programs that our agency may implement. Right now, we haven't broken down our budget or our projects at the office level. I'm happy to walk you through the other offices as well, because we're still really early on. And this year, I hope to hire about 20 program managers that together make a really interesting portfolio across those four focus areas. So in addition to proactive health, we have scalable solutions, making sure we meet people where they're at, whether it's scaling manufacturing or getting to people in their homes so that they have the best access to healthcare. Health science futures, so tools, technologies, and platforms that can advance a number of diseases. We are a disease agnostic organization, but we know our investments can help cancer, can help Alzheimer's disease prevention. And then finally, resilient systems. So creating and integrating capabilities that may exist already today, but by integrating them, we create a greater whole. So we will fund across those areas right now, but we haven't set 25% for each of those offices. We're not yet there as an organization.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for going over the four areas, all incredibly important. I mentioned prevention as one that jumps out to me because it seems to be an area where the healthcare system might not be incentivized quite as much as responding and treating people who've already developed health problems. So I'm curious how that one will look, maybe in particular. I know they all are interesting in their own way, but I think you've hired or you've part of your staff is health economists. And I'm interested in the role that they play in the money-making potential for, if you will, for preventive health, where the benefits may be longer term in the sense of keeping people healthy as they get older, and all of the health span consideration that has, I think, become increasingly important in conversations lately related to health. Is that the role that the health economists play? Do they help tell the story of why prevention is important when working with program managers and stakeholders on health innovations?
Yeah, so I guess I'll first actually by framing the way that we look at the challenge a little bit differently, perhaps than prevention. So we've actually really intentionally named that focus area proactive health, because while we know that some of these investments may prevent disease, it could also be that perhaps somebody already has a disease that they're managing, but we want to proactively help them achieve the greatest health that they possibly can. Mm-hmm. Even if they have, for example, type 1 diabetes, there's standard of care that we want to be able to advance. And so that's just kind of one lens that I want to provide to you as we think about that office. But you asked specifically about health economists, and we actually don't have any on staff yet. That's an active position that we're hiring for. So I can use this platform as an opportunity to let folks know that we're really excited about health economists and bringing them onto the team. And the reason why is we know that cost and accessibility are really a challenge for healthcare right now. And we want to make sure that as we build programs, we are thinking about those technologies. There's different ways you can approach them. We can be thinking about things like supply chain and the impact that will have on cost. We can be thinking about incentives to work together with FDA on accelerated approvals, for example. Would that be an incentive that can help drive down cost? And so having the staff on board to help do some of those analytics will be incredibly helpful. Where this is also really important in the proactive health office in particular is that it could be that, you know, spending, let's say, $600 on a diagnostic might sound like a lot, but if that's preventing a disease that over the course of the disease may cost $600,000, those are numbers that we want to start tracking so that when we look at the health outcomes for individuals, we can measure, you know, their benefits of, you know, improvement of quality of life, but also the economic benefit of those investments that we make at ARPA-H and really make that quantitative so we can bring that back to decision makers, you know, back to the commercial sector and those that will develop these, back to the payers who, going back to that example of a diagnostic, if we can figure out how to reimburse the diagnostic to prevent a disease, that's really going to be where we want to be both financially, but also from a health perspective.
And of course, we now have a tangible example of an ARPA-H program, which I certainly want to talk about a week ago on May 18th, I believe, ARPA-H announced its first program called Nitro. And I've heard it said that Nitro's goal is to have phase one clinical trials completed at the end of Nitro's five-year timeframe, which is really exciting. Can you tell me about some of the thinking that went into deciding that ARPA-H's first program should be novel innovations for tissue regeneration in osteoarthritis, which I believe is the goal of Nitro?
That's right. You just defined the Nitro acronym, which is Novel Innovations for Tissue Regeneration in Osteoarthritis. And there's, you know, a little bit of whimsy in that title. So as our first program to really add Nitro to our mission to accelerate better health outcomes for everyone, really, I couldn't think of a better program to launch and really show what the type of vision and ambition that ARPA-H can have when we're given, you know, this, all of the authorities that we have to go after these big programs. It was really asking the question, what if we could make our joints heal themselves? The technology focus of this program is looking at non-invasive procedures that can enhance bone regeneration, cartilage regeneration, which are both needed often at a damaged joint, and even replacement of joints altogether from human cells that can be grown in a lab and then delivered to a patient where we don't have to go with, you know, some of the metal implants that we have today. And a lot of the thinking, you know, we didn't start by saying, you know what, we should have an osteoarthritis program to start at ARPA-H. It was really looking into the program managers that came to ARPA-H that wanted to be a part of solving a really big problem in health. And this program manager in particular, Ross Urich, came forward. He's a doctor himself. He's a surgeon and said, you know, I did the math and the impact of the number of patients that I could help in my daily practice is pretty significant. And that's why I became a doctor. But I did the math and looking at ARPA-H, I can impact millions of people if I can launch a program that can help joints heal themselves. And so you probably know osteoarthritis has an oversized impact in underserved communities in particular. And so that's really, you know, as we launch this program, we want to make sure not only are we doing this amazing innovation for this capability, but making sure that we're getting it across the finish line to some of the patients that have the toughest time accessing this care and can really use it the most.
Osteoarthritis has a huge impact on millions of Americans, affecting more than 32 million Americans. I read in your press release, and economic burden of more than $136 billion per year. And also just on a personal level, you know, the invasive replacement surgeries are, you know, a real burden on people. And so, you know, if we can develop some of these innovations that are in the discussion, such as injections for regenerative health of the joint, it seems like it's a huge step forward. Is it possible that this program could lead to discoveries about regenerative medicine that could be helpful in other areas of health beside osteoarthritis? Or are ARPA-H's programs so focused on specific engineering solutions that those kinds of unforeseen benefits are less likely than you might see with more open-ended basic research?
It's such a great question. And, you know, for the Nitro program, part of the lens that we use when we launch these programs is understanding the impact, not only to a given patient, but also to the field in general. And so regenerative medicine, we know, is still a growing field. There's a lot left to discover, and we're confident that the advances that Ross and the teams that he funds make will not only, of course, lead to innovation for osteoarthritis, but more broadly across the ability to manufacture cells that can be used for regeneration, and really have those learnings of how do you deliver those cells. So I believe that this is, it's not quite a platform technology, but we will have the proof of concept in it, in the indication for osteoarthritis, but a lot of those learnings should be able to be applied elsewhere. And I want to just kind of flag this lens is really important to me as a director. When the program managers come forward to pitch a program, I look not just at that, you know, the patients I can impact, but this the possibility to impact the greater state of the art. Because to be honest, a lot of these programs make such ambitious shots on goal that they may not succeed. And we want to make sure that if this is a failure in terms of reaching the end goal, that we're going to learn a lot along the way and be very transparent about both the successes and the failures of the program. And absolutely, Nitro was one where this was, you know, crystal clear to me that even if we don't hit that end goal, which of course I hope that we do, and Ross is going to put, you know, every ounce of energy to make sure that we get across that finish line to that solution for patients. But we're gonna for sure learn a lot along the way.
That's so well put. And I do want to get into some of the strategic decision making that I think relates to what you said about platforms and what you said earlier about sort of the ways in which some of these innovations could apply to people who have different diseases. There are innovations that can apply to a broad swath of people who have health problems. Maybe there's a more compelling argument to be made for focusing on some of those programs. I read an interview where you said that you'll be able to justify your budget to Congress before you have results in 5 to 15 years from the ARPA-H programs, because in less time than that, you'll be able to show examples where Congress can see there's no other home for a project because the magnitude and timeline of the ARPA-H projects are so ambitious. Can you talk specifically about what makes the magnitude and timeline of this osteoarthritis program such that it isn't something that normal biotech and venture capitalists are already doing or funding? So there really couldn't be any other home for it. I just asked that because I think some people, you know, they look at ARPA-H and say, wow, this is really exciting, but like, why wouldn't biotech just be doing this? Or why wouldn't venture capitalists be doing it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that the Nitro program just so nicely is exemplary of this. So there's been, I think, a lot of anecdotes out there where using, you know, regenerative medicine, we've started to see some healing in the clinic, but there hasn't been a focused program of really taking in the complexity of bone and cartilage at the same time at a joint, which it's just really the whole formula soup to nuts. You can't just solve for one because you're not going to heal that joint. It's really having both of those present in the same program. Having the teams work across this, making sure there's agreement, even on the model systems that are used preclinically in the program. So we're working closely with the FDA, for example, to make sure that they can be stakeholders in the program early on, so that the innovations that we have can quickly then translate into some of those, you know, applications to move into the clinic. And so if there wasn't an ARPA-H investment, maybe this would all come along, you know, in the next 15 to 20 years, but it's, you know, putting all these pieces together, integrating them, and then making this really ambitious timeline on the back end of the program, as you said, five years to clinical proof of concept, is really only something an ARPA can do. And we do this by really resourcing the program well, that we buy down what we would call execution risk. We make sure the right team is present, whether it's academic teams or commercial teams that are going to develop this, or teams that consist of both, making sure that we have all the equipment that we need. If we're going to manufacture these cells, that we're identifying vendors that are going to be able to do this, and really have this all mapped out from the very beginning. And that allows us to really just focus on the technical risk. And so that's where what ARPA-H can, you know, give us that focus on this challenge going forward. Last but not least, before Ross started his program, he had to do a lot of due diligence and discovery on customers, patients, understanding what the marketplace was already working towards, to make sure that he was not redundant with any funding, not only at the National Institutes of Health, for example, but also in the commercial sector. He worked to, you know, kind of float what might be metrics for this program to make sure that he really was pushing beyond the state of the art that was out there. And he was able to do that because something unique that ARPA-H has is a transition office called PATIO, which is the Project Accelerator and Transition Innovation Office. So the PATIO team, they bring folks like venture capitalists to the table and you know, help our program managers really understand not only what is the state of the art in the marketplace? Where's the marketplace going? What is the white space that we can address? But also help quickly identify who are the players that we need to know about so that they're for sure to get the announcement when we say we're going to fund projects in this area, that we have those innovators be aware of ARPA-H. So, you know, we're still brand new. I've only been on the job for 7 months. And so a lot of our work is spreading the news that ARPA-H even exists. And so we're using that transition office to help us get the word out so that we are confident when we launch a program that we really know this is something that only an ARPA can do.
I have to follow up on that with a question about the pandemic and the rapid innovation that we saw with Operation Warp Speed and developing the COVID vaccines and rolling them out. Do you think without the pandemic and that example, there'd be an ARPA-H today? And in the context of Operation Warp Speed, do you think that ARPA-H could ever provide advanced purchase agreements in the way that Operation Warp Speed did?
Yeah. So, you know, thinking about the pandemic, while there was incredible technological progress, I do just want to, you know, acknowledge that there was still 1 million American lives lost. There was, you know, that can't be for naught. We need to take some of those advances, but we're still not there yet in having a solution to protect as many Americans as possible. Mm-hmm. But I think there's a kind of a learning in there that maybe not everybody is aware of, but for mRNA vaccines in particular, there had been over a decade ago, some early proofs of concept at the National Institutes of Health at the very fundamental science level that you know, looked like this should be possible. But it wasn't until a program manager by the name of Dan Wattendorf at DARPA really put together a program in this area to say, okay, you know, let's take mRNA vaccines to the next step where we integrate these capabilities, show that we can you know, start to have a routine way to manufacture this. And then get them into the clinic, that we were able to, you know, a decade ago, start to generate some of the data that formed the foundation for us to move as a nation and as a globe, honestly, so confidently towards that solution. And so if those investments had not been seeded a decade ago, I don't think we would have had the option to use an mRNA vaccine during the pandemic. And it's just so incredible how quickly we were able to move, you know, that new technology, but again, acknowledging still that 1 million lives lost. So, you know, that we hope to be the place to catalyze some of that investment. I don't know, there will be another pandemic for sure in the future. And so what are the investments that ARPA-H can contribute to in partnership with other parts of government? I think that's going to be important. For the procurement that you discussed, kind of, you know, what became Operation Warp Speed, that's not for ARPA-H. So we're really here to catalyze things that are very high risk to show that they're possible, but there are certainly other parts of the federal government that could be transition partners for us, like the BARDAs of this world, like the NIH, or, you know, even the private sector, of course, that we want to transition those. For us, success at ARPA-H is that something leaves the organization. We are not going to be long-term funding. You know, you should really think of our funding as transactional to buy down that risk. And when it's de-risked, then the, kind of the rest of the ecosystem can pick it up.
Important point about recognizing the tragedy of the pandemic, of course, and all of the, you know, missteps that we saw during the course of the pandemic, looking at accomplishment of getting the vaccines ready as quickly as we did, faster than, you know, many people would have predicted or even thought possible. I think a lot of people kind of wondered, why can't our institutions move that fast to find health solutions and innovations all the time? So now in the context of ARPA-H, I think one of the questions that came up during the conversations around ARPA-H before the agency got started last year was, why not just reform HHS, NIH, and FDA, making the existing agencies less risk-averse and less bureaucratic, more solution-oriented? What do you say to people who kind of point their finger at, why not, you know, reform those parts of the federal government before we, you know, create a new part?
Yeah. So, your question of, why can't we always do that for all diseases in some ways is why I came to ARPA-H. Like, why can't we? I think we should be able to give a shot on goal, not only in a time of crisis. We can together clearly do incredible things in this country. And it shouldn't take crisis to always get us there. And I really want to create the culture of innovation, not just for our program managers and our feds that we work with, but the partners that we're going to fund out there and help us get to those solutions and do those great things and really help advance this across a number of diseases. I think that is within our abilities. And what ARPA-H is, going to address, one of the challenges is there is so much great innovation that happens in a lab, that happens in a small company, but the gap to getting it out into the real world, into the hands of patients, of healthcare providers, doctors and nurses, community health workers, is incredible. And so we really are here to address that specific gap. That is one sliver in this ecosystem. And so, we are absolutely not here to reform anything, but what we don't make policy either, but what we are here to do is kind of to create those proofs of concepts, those demonstrations to bring to the rest of HHS. If we have a really compelling platform that can be used for a number of diseases and there isn't a regulatory capability for that, well, FDA is willing to work with us on that. And so it's really just important that we're engaging those partners very early, because we're going to be innovating so quickly on the technology side. We don't want on the back end, a policy or, some other barrier that's non-technical to be a challenge to getting this into the hands of Americans. And so that's very much a part of what we do as well, is making sure that we're looking for all those potential frictions down the road and addressing them so that when the technology is ready, this is ready to roll out. This is really built into the design of how we address programs. So each program manager has to address a series of 10 questions called the Heilmeier questions. We've adopted this from DARPA, where our business model is based after the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, who have a series of 8 questions that define everything from what is the problem that you're trying to solve? How's it done today? What's new in your approach that this is, the evidence that's going to be game changing? What's the impact? And then a series of questions around cost and duration and the metrics and milestones. At ARPA-H, we've also added, how are we addressing cost and accessibility? Because we know that can be a blocker downstream, but also user experience. We want to create tools that Americans want to enthusiastically adopt, that we want them to say, I want that ARPA-H solution because they've really thought about how to address my problem, and have those patients, have those healthcare providers be a part of the solution all along the way, and hear their voices. And this is really, me coming from industry, it's like bringing a product mindset that we have to do, keep designing and reiterating on the solutions that we bring forward so that we can, really bridge that gap from innovation to getting out to patients. And then last but not least, the question 10 is, how are we addressing, but the potential for miscommunication around our technologies and misinformation and make sure that we're messaging things in a way that is intentional and makes clear, what the benefits are and what the technology does, because that can also be a downstream barrier if people don't understand, what the capability is used for.
I did want to circle back to the decision-making and the choices among sort of different things that ARPA-H could focus on. And I wrote an article about ARPA-H a couple of years ago and talked with someone named Matthew Might, scientist at UAB, whose 12-year-old son passed away from a rare disease. And his experience with his son's illness was his entry point to the need for better health innovation. And he described the concept for an ARPA-H agency as the agency of urgency, referring to how patient communities are looking for cures, in real time, right now. And one of the challenges of health innovation, as is, there are these patient communities that all feel that way, right, about their specific disease. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about this challenge of figuring out, as you sort of choose these different areas that seem like really ripe for health innovation, how do you choose the ones that, with all these patient communities sort of advocating for a particular disease, all of which are meritorious, right, in their own way. What's the decision making? Yeah, how do you decide?
Yeah, so this is, I think what's really exciting for me about ARPA-H is that our approach is really a portfolio based approach. So not a single dollar of the $2.5 billion of in appropriations that ARPA-H has is aligned to a single disease or a single technology. So we really have the freedom as the program managers in our organization to pursue the problems that we think we can have the greatest impact on. And so when we hire program managers, this is really a bottoms up process. So not only are these individuals, you know, incredible CVs, but they have a big problem in health that they want to solve. And so, you know, Ross decided to address osteoarthritis, but we may have program managers in the future looking at different types of surgery or imaging solutions or perhaps rare diseases, to your example. And all of those are completely in scope for ARPA-H. And if you look at the programs that we'll fund this year, it is really a snapshot and a reflection of our program managers. And 5 years from now, it should look totally different. We'll be making different investments. We'll be catalyzing different parts of that ecosystem. And, you know, that decision-making comes, we hire the person for their idea and for their resume and ability to do. We need to, this is a group of doers. Mm-hmm. And folks that bring the urgency that you described. So the Congress has given us the opportunity to bring on program managers for a base term of 3 years, renewable for up to another 3 years. So that means in that base 3 year terms, every 2 weeks that goes by, 1% of their time as a program manager has elapsed. And so that means they're super motivated to solve this problem. And we give them a team of business operators to help them get the contracts, you know, in place to give them some of the technical experts that can help them get there. And so that decision-making, there's kind of an initial decision at the hiring phase that, like, you know, yes, this person and this project is aligned to ARPA-H, but then once they're on board, there's they actually do an internal they do this discovery process that I mentioned where they talk to a lot of experts, they figure out you know, are they hitting the right metrics? They answer those Heilmeier questions again in greater depth and build confidence with the health economists, et cetera, that we're gonna be able to launch this. And then that decision goes to a science and technology board that consists of business operators, of technical experts inside of ARPA-H, and myself. So the program manager makes the pitch for their new start for their program. We all weigh in, but ultimately I'm the decision maker. And so that is the purview of the director of ARPAs in general, is that we make it really lean so that program manager can you know, put forward a risky program and I can approve a risky program from the technical risk perspective, of course. We, you know, utmost safety to patients, but we want to be able to take on the technical risk. And then what that looks like, a program approval, is then I release a budget to that program manager that they help define and justify. And then that program manager then becomes a decision maker on, you know, what are the teams that are going to be used to select this, to pursue and solve this problem. And so by this very lean decision-making process, it allows us to take on these big audacious projects. If we decide everything by committee, that's one way to really dilute risk and have a very non-risky program at the end of the day. So, you know, it's really important for an ARPA to have that autonomy and that decision-making ability as we move forward.
Some experts I've talked with support another priority for ARPA-H that I think has implications for being proactive and preventive and could be a solution for not one, but multiple diseases. And here I'm talking about therapies that could potentially slow down the aging process. And so I don't know if I've come across Matt Kaeberlein. He's a biogerontologist who is at the University of Washington up until just recently. And he's been kind of like a vocal advocate. You know, he talks about how aging is the greatest risk factor for every major disease that NIH is studying, yet half of 1% of the NIH budget goes to researching the biology of aging. And he talks about how an ARPA-H sized budget would, you know, could potentially, or some portion of that budget could push the field forward at a pace that is unprecedented. What do you think about that argument? Are you interested in that area of research and innovation? And do you think that it's ripe for the types of targeted engineering solutions that ARPA-H is really known for and best suited to?
Yeah, I think aging and longevity is a really interesting area. And some might argue that a program in osteoarthritis would be yeah. related, of course, to some of those processes. You know, I'm a woman and ultimately will have to manage, osteoarthritis and bone degeneration as I age. That is certainly a consequence of that aging. So, generally speaking, to answer your question, you know, yes, absolutely, it's in scope for us. What I tell people, whether you're talking about longevity or aging or whatever your disease du jour may be, what's important is having that program manager champion that's excited about solving a problem in that area. And so I ask, you know, I would challenge somebody like Dr. Camberlin to say, okay, whether maybe you or perhaps you can think of a colleague that may align really well to the ARPA business model that's excited about taking on a 3-year term to, you know, become a program manager and actually define what a problem set is in this area and look for solvers to identify in this case, some, you know, the basic foundation of aging, but then, you know, leaning that into how can we address health outcomes? Is it a therapeutic advancement? Is it a behavioral advancement? Is there some other technological advancement that ARPA-H can contribute to bring that across the finish line? That's really, you know, what we're looking for. And absolutely those types of programs would be inside our portfolio, but it's that, I get that question a lot. Does ARPA-H work on X? Well, if we have a program manager working on that, or we have somebody who's submitted a concept to our open broad agency announcement, which is where we bring in projects from the outside and fund them here at ARPA-H. And that's already open here. We're soliciting ideas, you know, that's how we get to fund those areas. I'm not laying out an agenda beyond those focus areas that I shared with you to say, you know, these are the projects we're going to fund this year. It's very bottoms up. Our program managers help decide that.
Excellent. That makes a lot of sense and seems really, really fair. And for it to be driven by, you know, the project managers coming to you and saying, hey, there's this area that is really promising and laying out the pros, cons, taking it sort of case by case seems to be a very sensible approach. So I believe that you said in your press conference this month, you emphasized digital health. I think you said that there's so much excitement that you have that we could see fast progress in digital health. I wondered if you could share maybe like a few examples. Again, it kind of depends on what the project managers bring to you, but are there any specific areas of digital health that maybe are especially exciting to you that you make that, you know, a little bit more tangible for people listening and maybe also for potential program managers who are listening?
Sure. You asked the question, so I'm gonna dig in. This is one of my favorite questions around the digital health space. So ARPA, in general, ARPAs tend to have return on investment, or, you know, we reach the goals that we're shooting for on the 10-15 year horizon. You know, this is, we're throwing javelins into the future, right? That's what we're not looking for a solution 6 months from now, although we want to get this out the door. And so I do believe, however, that on the digital health side, there are some more near-term solutions, just given how quickly technology has been moving forward. And so one place is digital histopathology. And so, you know, when you get a disease diagnosis and some of the samples are looked at in kind of a research perspective, this is they look at the pathologies of those tissue samples, whether it's neurodegenerative diseases, whether it's cancers. And there is a real gap in delivering some of the ability to quickly kind of look at some of that imaging and do diagnostics and getting an assist from a computer in addition to kind of a pathologist expert. This is an area that is moving very, very quickly, especially with, you know, some of the AI and machine learning approaches that are advancing. And so I'm really excited about this area as a general platform capability for us to advance the state of the art across a number of diseases. Another area is really just patient records. Right now we have a system in the United States that is very bespoke, that individual clinics and hospitals often, you know, have a fit for purpose solution. And we need to have a way to extract a little bit more of a universal database to be looking more and more at, healthcare outcomes that are linked to given procedures, given technologies that might go into clinical trials, and really starting to gather that real world evidence of how not only a technology may have an impact initially in a clinical trial, but longer term, what are the actual benefits that go into place. And so during the pandemic, we saw some pretty interesting, a lot of data reporting happening. Of course, even if you just think about COVID testing and then tracking the variants, we don't have a universal way to do this across the United States. Each state has their own process. And so I'm really excited about thinking about ways we can do that more efficiently, that we can share information more quickly for situational awareness, whether it's, you know, emergence of a pathogen, or understanding, wow, disease incidence in the city of this, you know, chronic disease has increased. Maybe there's something happening here. Last but not least, I just really want to flag, there is a lot of patient data that's been collected out there, but it's a pretty biased data set, biased to you know, the clinical centers that currently have those capabilities. It's not representative of the entire United States. And the disease incidence that kind of varies by different regions. And so I'm really hopeful that as we build out new data infrastructure and systems for our own programs, we can start to reduce that bias in those data sets, pushing it further and further out from some of the centers of excellence that have those capabilities today to just, you know, a broader swath of rural America, where we can, you know, have the best data set possible to train those AI models and just get better as we do that. And so I'm super excited to usher that in, as we launch new programs at ARPA-H.
Yeah. And I imagine each of those three buckets that you just talked about are super interesting. And I imagine that the information sharing platforms and databases that you talked about to sort of connect these bespoke systems that we have to each other, there are probably some really interesting analogies to the DOD, the DARPA work that you did when it comes to, you know, ways to better share intelligence with, you know, the different agencies and departments and other stakeholders who are operating in that area. I imagine that you can pull some of those lessons learned from your experience with DARPA to bring to some of those information sharing challenges we have in health. Is that right?
Yeah, you hit it exactly. This is one of my favorite topics to bring up, because there's great examples. So if you take, Army, Navy, Air Force, right? And, you know, in our armed forces, those systems across those different services talk seamlessly to each other, so that when we have, you know, offensive or defensive targeting of capabilities, we don't lose a millisecond in those capabilities, because that sharing is absolutely seamless. So we figured it out. We figured it out in a really complex setting already. And so, you know, bringing in solvers from different areas that may not know anything fundamentally about health, but they know how to get some of those systems talking to each other, are, I think, some of the non-traditional players that we're going to be able to bring in to play to solve some of these challenges in health. And that's essentially one of the things that drew me back to the government from the private sector, because having been in the private sector during the pandemic, being part of teams that brought together non-traditional players that I would have never dreamed of, when I had spent a longer time career in the federal government, just really, you know, got me re-energized to return to government and give examples of ways we can bring non-traditional players together to create new solutions in those public-private partnerships. There's incredible things that government does. There's incredible things the private sector does. But when we do them together, it's kind of a superpower. And I want to be able to demonstrate that, you know, through the work of our program managers, through the authorities that the Congress and the president have given us, that we're so lucky to have, really, really show that a model like ARPA-H can you know, bring better health outcomes to all Americans.
Yeah. I previously have worked for the federal government and as well. And it's an interesting parallel, I think, between ARPA-H and follow on the heels of the pandemic and an analogy to the Department of Homeland Security being stood up after 9/11. I actually worked at DHS, and some missteps obviously that have happened with DHS. So I don't know if that's the best analogy to make here, but you know, with information sharing and intelligence sharing, that has been a huge challenge. I think that it was one of the reasons that, you know, people thought that a Department of Homeland Security could help to their sort of these bespoke agencies and departments that all had their own systems for intelligence, and DHS was at least in theory supposed to bring some of that intelligence together in a more cohesive manner. But anyway, so under ARPA-H, under your leadership, I'm sure things are going to go much more smoothly. I'm really excited by your vision, and it's great to hear you talk about everything that ARPA-H can do and accomplish.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. You know, we are just so excited to be here and have the opportunity to do this great experiment in government and really show what we can do. So thanks again, Matt.
Thanks for checking out the Making Sense of Science podcast. If you like the show and you want to hear more from the best thinkers of our time to help make sense of the latest health innovations and their impacts, please hit the follow button. And in the meantime, visit our online magazine at leaps.org. where you can read in-depth articles that explore health breakthroughs through the lens of rational optimism. Thanks for reading, listening, and most importantly, thinking about what you find on leaps.org.